بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
لله الأسماء الحسنى ندعوه بها، لله الأسماء الحسنى ندعوه بها.
Thank you to Brother Muhammad Sabur for that really informative talk. Just by way of giving this kind of a personal understanding, I think it's really important, the point that Brother Muhammad made repeatedly, but I think bears stressing, is even if you think that you understand that you're going to tell the truth the whole time, even if you think you understand that you've done nothing wrong, that you can share a lot with the FBI agent, call or contact a lawyer first and do it with them. And so just to give you an example of why that's useful, I had a friend a year ago who got in touch with me, was very nervous because he said the FBI had called him and had said that they needed to talk to him, and that he asked what it was about, and they told him that it was about a fight that he had been around, some argument. And now he was racking his brain trying to understand what fight he's been around for the past 25 years of his life, trying to think through every single incident he's been near, what it could be about, just very, very nervous. And we told him, okay, first let's get an attorney. I couldn't help him out because our firm doesn't let you represent anyone outside of the firm context. So I said, let's find someone else who can do this, plus I don't have that area of expertise. So we found some lawyers in New York. There's a group called CUNY Clear that does this kind of work. They're really, really great. He called them. He said, will you guys represent me? They said, yes. They called the FBI, and they said, what is this about? I don't remember what the FBI told them exactly, but they changed what it was about. It was no longer about an argument. And they said, okay, we can meet up with you. We'll be his lawyers. We'll meet up with you when you need. Let us know. They said, we'll get back to you, and they never got back to them. That ended it. So whatever the FBI was looking for, part of what they were looking for was someone uninformed that they could talk to without a lawyer. So even if you think that you know everything, for one, none of us know everything. The nafs is an interesting thing in that we always assume that we know everything very, very well. We're always the best at everything. Everyone's a lawyer, a doctor, an economist, everything. But go with a lawyer. Call your lawyer, a friend that's a lawyer, someone that you trust, or as you just saw, get in touch with some advocates, and you'll be in a much better situation. So with that said, now we're going to be switching tracks a little bit and have a talk by Brother Sean Rizvi, who is going to be talking about employment law. He works for the Bosham Corporation and has focused on this area in particular, different employment discrimination issues, general employment law issues. And so inshallah, he'll be able to give us a little bit more insight as to an area that I think many of us also deal with, which is in the context of my job, what am I allowed to deal with, and what how can people treat me and how can I deal with others. So let's start off again with one more loud salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala
Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, everybody. So I was told I only had 10 minutes, and thankfully I made a 10-minute guide to employment law. Basically, as Brother Hadi said, I am just going to be touching on some basic issues relating to work. Obviously, most of us are inshallah employed, or if not inshallah, we'll soon be gainfully employed. So it's important to have a sense of our rights in the workplace. And this is a very, very brief introductory overview to some of those rights and responsibilities. If you have further questions, it's always best to consult an attorney. Just to get started off, the basic doctrine that you all should be aware of is within the framework of employment law, it's called employment at will. Now, what this means is that employees may be terminated by their employer at any time for any reason or for no reason at all. So as an employee, if you're working for a company or an organization, the general rule is that they can let you go for pretty much any reason, whether that's production, whether that's attendance issues, or anything of that sort. So you have, in regards to maintaining your employment, you're starting off with basically nothing. You have no rights in that sense, and the employer has all the rights to terminate you. Now, there are some very important exceptions to that rule, as we know. And some of those I'm going to talk about being, you know, the discrimination statutes. But in general, the three main exceptions to that are those that are made by statute or made by law, those that are made by in accordance with public policy, and those that are made in accordance with contract. So just to give you an example of a statute that is an exception to this rule that an employer can fire you for any reason, in Texas, the Texas Whistleblower Act protects public employers from taking adverse personal actions, such as termination, against employees who, in good faith, report violations of the law committed by their employers or co-workers to an appropriate law enforcement authority. Now, What this is saying is that if you report a violation of a law committed by your organization or a coworker to a law enforcement authority and you get terminated for that, that's actually illegal. Now, there's obviously a lot of key terms in the statute, some of them being public employer, adverse personal action, good faith, appropriate law enforcement authority, etc. So it's not, don't try to apply this law just by looking at its face and, you know, make a decision just by reading the statute. You should consult a lawyer, like I said, when you're dealing with these kinds of issues. Secondly, public policy. Public policy means that there are some reasons that courts have made to prevent, to sort of hinder this rule, the employment at will doctrine. So sometimes there's an overriding public policy reason why we wouldn't want employers to be able to fire employees for any reason whatsoever. So just to give you an example, I remember reading about a case in New Jersey where a gas station attendant was working at a gas station where his employers had this rule that he had to be behind the desk and kind of serving customers during his entire shift, meaning he couldn't leave for that shift at all, and except for like restroom breaks and things like that. But he couldn't, in no circumstances could he leave the actual gas station. And what happened was he saw a fight actually happening outside the gas station between two men. And I think, you know, he obviously being a good Samaritan, he wanted to get involved. And so he rushed out there and, you know, broke it up. And his employer actually, you know, they had footage of this and they saw this, so they terminated him because he broke his rule of employment, which was that he couldn't leave. Well, he sued the gas station, and a court found that actually, even though New Jersey had this rule, this employment at will rule that said the employer can fire you for whatever reason, it was actually a violation of public policy for them to fire this employee in the circumstance because he was trying to do something good. So again, that's a very limited exception to the rule. In general, your employer can fire you for any reason or for no reason at all. Lastly, contract. Sometimes, and again, this is also very rare, your employer might make a contract with you and state during the course of your employment that, you know, you're not going to be terminated except for cause. You know, this might be an oral contract or this might be in your actual employment agreement that you signed. Again, this is extremely limited. This almost never happens. So I would be wary of depending on that. Most people in this room, I would guess, fall under the general rule, which is that you can be terminated for no reason at all. So that's just the kind of basic framework to keep in mind. Now, there are some important exceptions to that, as I mentioned. In terms of statutes, the most important exception to that is Title VII. That stands for Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. What that rule does is that it prohibits employers of 15 or more employees from discriminating against employees on the basis of their protected status. And protected status can include things such as their race, their age, their national origin, their religion, their gender, and a few other categories that I'm not going to talk about today. So, you know, most of us, I think, have heard of this rule that it is illegal for an employer to discriminate against you on the basis of, for example, your religion. As an important aside that I just want to throw into that is that there are some occupations in which it is possible for an employer to discriminate against you. So, for example, and this is what's called a bona fide occupational qualification or a BFOQ. So when an employee's protected status affects his or her ability to perform a job, that status might be considered a bona fide occupational qualification. So what this means is, for example, if you have an Islamic school and it's interested, you know, it's a K-12 Islamic school and it's interested in hiring a new teacher to teach, you know, religion to the young children there, two applicants apply. One of them is Catholic and one of them is Muslim. Assuming that the Catholic, you know, applicant has much better qualifications, has better references, interviews better, and is more qualified for the job, it's actually not illegal for the Islamic school to discriminate against the Catholic man and say, we want to take the Muslim teacher. Why? Because being a Muslim is a bona fide occupational qualification to teach in an Islamic school. You know, similarly, some high-end, you know, restaurants or hotels might have a bathroom attendant, right? And obviously, if you have a bathroom attendant, for a men's bathroom, you'd want that to be a man. So if a woman applies for that job and she doesn't get it, the employer can easily say, well, being a man was a bona fide occupational qualification for this position. So there again are some exceptions to the general rule, but here the important thing to remember is the general rule, which is that it's illegal for most employers to discriminate against you on the basis of any of these categories that you see there, as well as a few others. Third, I want to talk about retaliation. Retaliation is another important rule to remember within the context of employment law. Basically, you know, a lot of us might feel that we are discriminated against at work, and the step to take there is that we might contact an attorney, and our attorney might file a charge with what's called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And the EEOC, as it's called, investigates all the claims of employment discrimination or harassment, any of those issues that occur at work. The EEOC is responsible for investigating those. Now, if you file a charge against your employer with the EEOC, or your attorney files a charge with the EEOC against your employer, it is then illegal for the employer to retaliate against you. So, as it says here, this rule prohibits retaliation against an individual who opposes or participates in an investigation into unlawful discrimination. So either you could file a charge with the EEOC, or maybe your coworker files a charge of employment discrimination, and as part of that charge, the EEOC wants to interview you and ask you what happened with this individual. Was he discriminated against? What did you see at work? If you participate in that investigation, you're completely protected. An employer cannot take any sort of adverse personal action against you, whether that's firing you, whether that's changing your hours, whether that's demoting you, whether that's moving you to a different workspace, anything like that. It's completely illegal for an employer to do that. Just to give you a tangible example here, let's suppose a boss's employer refuses to allow him to pray on the job, but allows people of other religions to take some time off for prayer. On May 1st, a boss files a claim of unlawful discrimination against his employer with the EEOC. A boss knows that his employer found out about this charge, about his complaint to the EEOC on May 7th, 6 days later. And 3 days later, a boss is demoted to a lower position. Well, here a boss has a pretty good claim of retaliation because he filed a charge and he knows that, you know, his company received some documentation about his charge on May 7th. And 3 days after they received that documentation, he was actually demoted to a lower position. So, you know, it's clear that looking at the circumstantial evidence that there likely was some retaliation happening here. Obviously, it's not a foolproof case. You have to consult an attorney. But this is just a general idea of some of the facts you should be looking for if you're concerned about retaliation. Now, here, another important type of conduct that is encompassed within the employment law realm is harassment. Harassment is defined as unwelcome conduct that's based on your race, color, religion, sex, national origin, age, disability, genetic information, etc., that becomes a condition of employment, or a conduct that is so severe or pervasive to create a hostile work environment that a reasonable person would consider intimidating, hostile, or abusive. So here it's important to know that you know, offensive conduct is kind of what we're trying to understand here, and that can include things such as offensive jokes, slurs, name-calling, you know, religious slurs, physical assault, threat of physical assault, ridicule, putting up insulting pictures or insulting, you know, billboards or signs about Muslims. These are all types of harassment that is not permitted, you know, within the workplace. And your employer has an obligation to correct any sort of harassment that they become aware of. So here the next line says that there's different types of harassment. You can be harassed, obviously, by your supervisor or by your coworker. And if you feel that you are being harassed, you should report it to your immediate supervisor because, as I mentioned, generally supervisors have a legal obligation to correct any sort of harassment that's occurring at the workplace. And if they don't do that, the company that you're working for can be liable for that harassment. It's also important to remember that Title VII, this law that we're speaking about, is not a general, what's referred to in the decisions as not a general code of civility. What that means is that Title VII is not defining every action that is legal or illegal. A lot of that depends on what, you know, the circumstances of your case and what a court, you know, deems is relevant evidence. It's not defining the boundaries precisely. So you should again consult a lawyer to find out what the likelihood of your success in a lawsuit might be. Okay, another important rule I want to talk about that might be applicable to a lot of people here is what's called the Family and Medical Leave Act. This applies to not all employers, but some. Its application is limited to employers who have 50 or more employees, and it only applies to those employees who have worked for their employers for at least 12 months, and within those 12 months have worked at least 1,250 hours. So that comes out to about 25 hours a week. Also, for an employee to be eligible for the FMLA, they have to have at least 50 other employees within their organization working within 75 miles of their work site. So, you know, if you're all spread out and you only have 25 people in California and 10 people in Detroit and 10 people in New York, you know, this might not apply to you. What this rule basically says is that employees who are eligible under FMLA are entitled to 12 weeks of unpaid leave during any 12-month period for one or more of the following reasons. Number one, birth of a child and placement of a child with the employee for adoption or foster care. So again, you can either give birth or your spouse can give birth, or you could adopt a child. Number two, to care for a spouse, son, daughter, or parent of the employee with a serious health condition. And notice that doesn't include siblings, so you don't have the right to care for your sibling and take this time off. Number three, a serious health condition that makes an employee unable to perform the functions of his or her position. So a lot of this is very statutory. The courts have interpreted all of the terms that I'm defining here in 1, 2, and 3. For example, serious health condition, there's a very specific definition for that. You know, number three, a serious health condition that makes an employee unable to perform the functions of his position. That's also very specifically defined in the law. So it's best to consult an attorney if you think that that might apply to you. But it's here I'm just giving you a general idea of the law, and that, you know, you should have general awareness that these rights might apply to you in this case. And, you know, FMLA is very common in the workplace. So, you know, if you have an HR department or someone in the HR department that you're comfortable speaking to, you know, ask them about whether you can take FMLA leave for a specific situation. Generally, they'll be very open with you. If you do apply for FMLA leave, they have to tell you whether you're eligible within 5 days. So you should be able to make a quick determination as to whether you can take time off from work or not. Just to continue on FMLA very briefly, An employee who takes FMLA leave is entitled to be restored to the job that he or she held prior to that leave, or an equivalent position with equivalent benefits, pay, and other terms and conditions of employment. So you can't take FMLA and then come back 12 weeks later and then have your employer say that, you know, we gave you this other position that's slightly at a slightly lower salary than what you were at before. That's completely illegal. An employer may not interfere with, restrain, or deny any employee's right to request FMLA leave, or discriminate or retaliate. Again, going back to the idea of retaliation we talked about in the last few slides, retaliate against an employee for requesting or taking FMLA leave. So if you take this leave, an employer cannot, you know, change your job status in any way as a result of that that request that you make. Additionally, an employer may obviously require you to provide medical certification to support the need for medical leave. So that's pretty common sense. You know, if you say you're going to be out on leave, they can require you to provide notice. That's completely legal. If you need to take this leave in an emergency, yeah, that is also you know, permissible within the law. You have to provide certification of, you know, why you took that leave, some sort of medical documentation upon your return, and you generally have about 2 weeks to do that upon your return. Finally, the last thing I want to talk about, because it's applicable to many people here, is religious accommodations. Here, the general rule that you should keep in mind is that employers do have an obligation to reasonably accommodate your religious beliefs and practices, unless doing so would be an undue hardship on their operation of their business. So a few key terms here. Reasonable accommodation, what does that mean? Secondly, undue hardship, what does that mean? Again, these are things that you want to ask an attorney about, but I'll just give you a general, you know, glance into it. So this applies to things such as schedule changes for religious holidays. You know, let's say you want to take Eid off, or want to take some, you know, do a half day for Eid, and you don't have any remaining time off. Let's say you'd like to observe a job, obviously, or maintain a beard in your workplace, and maybe your employer has strict policies about facial hair. Things of that sort. Now, undue hardship. As I said, an employer generally has to accommodate you. And what you should do if you feel that you would like a reasonable accommodation for some sort of religious practice, whether that's a holiday or to pray in your office, is that you should talk to your supervisor and tell them exactly why you need that accommodation. They then have an obligation to talk to you about it and ask you more questions and to try to see if there's some sort of compromise where they can let you do what you need to do, whether that's prayer or take time off, while they can still, you know, maintain their business and continue to operate and continue their, you know, operations efficiently. Now, undue hardship is the one thing that might prevent you from getting a religious accommodation. What that means, and unfortunately courts have defined this very broadly, what that means is that your request for accommodation is either costly, it comprises workplace safety, it decreases efficiency, it infringes on the rights of other employees, or it causes other employees to do work that's more hazardous than they would normally do. If you're requesting repeated, religious days that have an effect on your company's operational efficiency, it's then possible for your company to say, no, we can't give you this leave. We can't allow you to do this during the work, during work time. It's again a question of fact, and the most important thing that you all should remember is that if you would like a religious accommodation, you should bring it up as soon as possible to your supervisor and mention what exactly you need and how you'd like to achieve that, and mention how you two can perhaps, at that point perhaps they might make a counter offer and tell you, well, we can't give you these days off, but we'll give you, these 2 days off and this other time as well. Perhaps they'll offer you a compromise. So they do have an obligation once you talk to them to engage in what's called an interactive process and to try to come to a compromise. That's pretty much all I wanted to mention to you all. Inshallah, that gave you kind of a brief overview of some of your rights and obligations at work. And inshallah, during the question and answer session, if you have further questions, I'd be happy to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Sean, for your presentation, for your intro into employment law. Our next speaker is Brother Dawood Waleed, and he works with CARE here in Michigan. He's their local expert on kind of related to the topic that we had in our first presentation. He's going to, he does topics on dealing with the FBI and interacting with them. So his topic for today is going to be interacting with the FBI and border control. So if you can please welcome him with a loud salwa.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله الذي ليس كمثله شيء وأفضل الصلاة والتسليم على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيبنا محمد الأمين وعلى أهل بيته الطاهرين الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد
أيها الأحباب السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته I will keep this my comments extremely brief because we start late, and I'd like to allow you all the time to have some questions for all of the panelists. How many of you know who CARE is before I go any further? Everyone? Okay, khalas. I can keep on going. I specifically want to focus on one issue that is a growing issue that we've dealt with at the CARE Michigan chapter in particular. And let me say, this is my fourth year in a row being here at Muslim Congress, being participating in this panel. And the first year, President George Bush was in office. And I can tell you today that in this one particular issue, as well as the FBI interrogation issue, things are worse now under President Obama than they were in the last year of Bush, as far as our complaints. Invasive religious questioning. We all know that when we fly back into the country, as well as crossing the border, and Michigan is a horrible location because of the situation pertaining to crossing back from Windsor driving, where we all, if we're citizens, legal residents, we have to answer certain questions, like how much money are you bringing back in? Do you have any food products with you? Where did you go to visit? How many days you were there, etc., which are bona fide questions. The issues that we've been running across are invasive religious questions by CBP, Customs Border Protection, such as, do you pray? How many times a day do you pray? Do you pray Salat al-Subh in Jama'ah? Who is your sheikh? Do you give zakat? Who are you paying? Who do you give your zakat, your khums to? These are totally illegitimate questions that are asked by Customs Border Protection. I would like to tell you that if you're asked these particular questions, which actually and technically violate the Department of Homeland Security's own guidelines, you can respectfully tell them, again, these for informational purposes, respectfully tell them that you decline to answer these types of questions. Now, obviously, coming back into the country, this is a type of legal limbo. There are certain questions or your right to invoke having an attorney. They can hold you there. We have cases. They held people 3 hours, 5 hours, 8 hours, coming back into the country under the guise of national security interests or making sure, you know, that they're keeping us safe. You know, so in this type of situation or circumstance, it's a little bit different than if an FBI officer or if your local police department comes to your workplace or to your home seeking to ask you questions you can politely decline and ask for the card. It's a little different. There's certain questions you have to answer, but not in regards to this invasive religious questioning. Now, we filed a lawsuit a little over 2 months ago in the federal court here, Eastern District Federal Court here in Detroit, against Customs Border Protection, TSA, which is also, we have complaints of them asking questions, similar type of questions, and the Federal Bureau of Investigations. What has happened is people come back into the country, they hold people, then they might call some FBI agents to also ask some more questions. Or what has happened is, and we have a number of complaints, but we picked the five best individuals we thought as plaintiffs. What happens is they're asked these questions or asked questions coming back into the country, and then there's basically a case opened up on them. So once they're back home, then the FBI agents come back and then ask them about their travel patterns, ask them these questions, and then or attempt to, and ask similar questions about, you know, what websites you're going on. So again, just reiterating what Brother Muhammad said, obviously when you're back home and you're inside the United States of America and that the FBI comes, then please take the business card, do not let them into your home, and have them talk with you through an attorney. CARE, we have 35 offices across these United States of America. Almost every single one of them has at least one attorney on staff. So you can come to our contact the CARE office, if not Muslim Advocates, you can contact CARE's office in your locality, and there's an attorney that can contact the FBI, they can contact law enforcement back for you. Now, let me make one comment in closing regarding our aqidah, our faith. Because as I talk about these things from a civil rights perspective, in the civil rights movement of African Americans, there were three types of people who were involved in the leadership of the civil rights movement. You had attorneys, people like Thurgood Marshall, who went and litigated cases, okay? You had the community organizers, people like organizations like SNCC, for instance. We had community organizers that were organizing some protests. Then you had the preachers and the religious leaders that gave people the religious guidance, okay? One of the names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is Al-Adl. Al-Adl means the just, but it means more than this. It means that God is the one that put everything in its rightful place. And the opposite of this, Adala, is Zulm. Imam Hussein sallallahu alayhi said, فَإِنِّي لَا يُرَيْدْ مَوْتْ إِلَّا سَعَادًا. He said, surely looking at death regarding the oppression, it is honorable, it's dignity. وَالْحَيَاتُ مَعَ الظَّالِمِينَ إِلَّا شَقَاوَ. But to have life with those who take away the rights of the people, the oppressors, to live this way is dishonorable. It's dishonorable. So we all have an Islamic obligation as we see injustice going on. Pakistan, Bahrain, Yemen, other places, we have a right to make dua, and we should support that. But there's different levels of zulm. And when any time someone is taking away the rights of any other human beings, including the United States of America, we have a moral responsibility is part of our aqidah, that we have to exert ourselves and not just turn a blind eye to the injustice. I have, just as we have a struggle at CARE, I know some of you know me very well, just as I have a struggle of being against the invasive strategies or the violation of our rights by federal law enforcement, I also have a struggle against those people in our community who want to make us into sheep. And the Uncle Toms and the sellouts are amongst us that say, well, let's just make a little money and let's not complain and blah, 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 blah. This gets us nowhere in this dunya and nowhere in the al-akhirah. Believe me when I tell you this. Because at the end of the day, what we're doing here is for the afterlife. It's not just that we live a comfortable life in America. If anyone's coming to you with this attitude, they're doing an injustice upon you. For real. So with that, I will sit down now, and we will allow ourselves for any questions. Aqulu qawli hadha wa astaghfirullah li wa lakum.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
So inshallah, what we're going to do is we're going to now take questions. You can ask questions relevant to the discussions here. Or if there are questions that you have that hopefully we can answer, we'll try to answer. As I think you've seen, the legal field is something where you have to have a specialty and know the area that you're focusing on. So it's possible we may not know the answer to every question, but we'll try our hardest. So inshallah, I have three written questions here. We'll start off with a question that's not written, and then we'll come to one of these one by one and go back and forth. If you want to give questions, if you're not comfortable asking a question publicly, feel free to write it and give it to us. If not, there's a brother up here, I believe, that has his hand up.
Yeah, I have a question for the brother from here. Mm-hmm. I read about a situation where a brother went to, he had a visit from the FBI, and he gave out his, he spoke to the gentleman, and then he took a trip with his father to Nicaragua, and when he tried to come back with his father from Nicaragua, they told him he's on the no-fly list, and so he had to, I think, take a flight to Tijuana, and then eventually what they found out is that the FBI is using this as a tactic to pull information. I wanted to see how common this is right now. You know, is this a fact, or is this a situation? Is this a fact, or is that just a story? Is this what's happening?
No, these cases have happened. They're not very widespread, but we dealt with a couple of cases. I know one was more very publicized, where there was a young man born and raised in the Washington, D.C. area, Somali American. He went to Yemen to study Arabic. Then he went to Egypt, and he was flying home. He got pulled off a plane, and then he was taken into custody and questioned at the embassy by the FBI. He was placed on a no-fly list. And then they took his passport. So what happened was, after it was a public ruckus made about, they gave him a temporary passport, but he couldn't fly, which was, the Egyptians wouldn't let him fly either, so I don't know, he had to take a boat back to America, I guess is what they thought. But we ended up filing a legal motion about this, and eventually he was allowed to fly back home, actually met the young man. I know of about 10 of these types of cases. Some of these people have gotten back home but haven't gotten any legal relief. Abdul Ali Musa, who's here right now, from Washington, D.C., he's on no-fly list. So like when he flies to Iran, what he has to do is he has to drive from D.C. into Canada and then take the flight from Toronto and then go to like Dubai or Abu Dhabi to then fly to Tehran. So this is an issue that's going on.
So first I'm going to read off one of the questions that we have here, and then we'll go back to the audience. So the question we have here, the first one is, how do you prove an oral contract? Now, just to clarify, is this an oral contract for employment or just an oral contract generally?
In general.
I can start off. if others have thoughts. So there's a couple of things to keep in mind with oral contracts. I'm not an expert in this, but just a broad idea. Firstly, some oral contracts aren't valid. So there's a concept called the statute of frauds, which part of it is explaining what contracts you have to have on paper. So for example, contracts that are for a certain length of time, that are for real property meaning a house, certain contracts like that are not valid unless they are written. But many contracts are valid. Many contracts that are oral are valid. And so part of what goes into trying to prove that is, for one, they're very hard to prove. So I'm actually working on a matter right now in for my where I actually work, where someone says that they had they gave a $5,000 loan to someone that was cash loan and was never written. And they really, we believe our client, we really think she gave the loan out. Her husband's a very, very bad person. They're now getting a divorce and she wants the money back. But it's very, 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 very hard to prove oral contracts because there's only, to the best of my knowledge, a few ways you can do it. One is, if there were witnesses to that, you can try to depose those witnesses. If there were other people that that person has made similar oral contracts with, you can try to speak with them, do interrogatories to them, like ask them questions, depose them. Or if there was a ordinary kind of course of business where that person would, for example, I would make an oral contract with Brother Muhammad Sabur where I say, every Thursday I'm going to give you $2,000 in exchange for you know, cleaning my house, right? So if I give him that money every, I don't know what date I said, but every Wednesday I give him that over a period of time, and you can show that the course of conduct was such that it would match an oral contract, that no one would do that other than if there was some kind of informal contract, that can sometimes work as well. So those are some ways that you can try to prove an oral contract, but they're very hard to do. And I'll leave that open for others if they feel like they can expound on that at all. Okay. So now we'll do one question from the audience, and we'll do another one that's written. If the sisters have a question, it would be nice to do women and then guys again. Okay, the brother.
I have a brother Muhammad. They all are talking about the coming back into the country. How about the domestic flights? We get, I cannot tell you how they treat us on the domestic flight, particularly. Whenever you try to pull the boarding pass, they first of all, internet is say no, you have, due to the security reason, you have to be checked in. Once you go, you give your ID, two TSA agents are behind you. Sir, would you come with us? And then start front of the public. What we can do to stop that?
That's an excellent question that I know a lot of community members face. I've used to face that myself in the past where I couldn't check in for flights online. I'll take a stab at it first, and I know I want to hand it over to Dawood as well because I know he has experience in this area. But the thing to do in that case is to go onto the Department of Homeland Security's website and to file what's called a DHS TRIP, T-R-I-P report. You can contact either Muslim Advocates or your local care chapter or other organizations that can assist you with that process. But that's basically a process by which you will, I hope if you, for example, have dates that you remember you traveled, look back through your email, find those dates that you traveled, and if you remember a few anecdotes about those experiences, you essentially report that to the Department of Homeland Security. And DHS is kind of a supervisory agency for TSA and the other security agencies. So what they'll do is they'll investigate it. They may ask you for further identifying information. It may be a bit of a back and forth process, but eventually, hopefully, what would come out of that is you would be issued a redress number. For those of you that book tickets online, you may have seen a little field when you fill out first name, middle name, last name, date of birth, gender, and then it'll ask if you have a TSA redress number. That redress number references a file that the TSA has where hopefully after they've cleared you, so that when you book that ticket, they'll know that, okay, we've already cleared this individual. Or it may be the case that you may not get cleared. I mean, there are different levels of scrutiny that people face when flying. The most extreme is the no-fly, but there are other restrictions where, for example, an individual, even when they check in at the airport, they do have to talk to a TSA agent, or they cannot check in online. There are different levels that people are subject to these policies. So my initial advice would be to go online, file a DHS TRIP report, report that to us, report that to your local care chapter, because it's important that our organizations know that this continues to happen and the exact ways in which this happens. As some reading material that you may want. At the Justice 360 table, I put out some copies of reports called Unreasonable Intrusions. And that's actually a report that Muslim Advocates authored in 2009, covering, describing the cases of American Muslims who have faced trouble flying, returning to the country. So you can read about how other people have gone through similar experiences. Okay.
Sisters, do you guys have any questions? Okay. We'll come to you, Brother, after one of the written questions. One of our written questions is, what is protected age? I heard age of 40 is protected category.
The question is, what is the protected age? I've heard that the age of 40 is a protected category. That is correct. Age 40 and above is a protected category in the law. What that means is that when an investigative agency is looking at an employer to see if they discriminate against older people, they'll generally look at all people above the age of 40 versus those under the age of 40 and see if they're treated differently. With that said, any employee has the right to file a claim on the basis of age discrimination, so you don't have to be over 40 to file a claim. You can be under the age of 40 if you feel you are being discriminated against on the basis of your age. I hope that answers the question.